This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana. Good afternoon, I'm Celeste Quinn. From the late 19th century and into the 1960s, thousands of African Americans were lynched in the United States. Today on the Afternoon Magazine, we talk about the history of lynching with writer Philip Dre. He's the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. The book is a history of mob violence directed against African Americans, often with the complicity of local authorities. Authorities often knew who had organized and carried out a lynching, but they refused to interfere or prosecute those responsible. The book also tells the stories of people who fought to end the practice, including Ida B. Wells, W.E.B. Du Bois, and the NAACP. Listeners, you can join the discussion this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments. Give us a call. In Champaign-Urbana, our number is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Outside Champaign-Urbana, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Our guest, Philip Dre, has written articles for many publications, including the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, and Mother Jones. He is the co-author of We Are Not Afraid, the story of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney. Dre's new book, At the Hands of Persons Unknown, is published by Random House. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Philip Dre, good afternoon. Welcome. Thank you for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Sure. This book came about, thanks very much, to a librarian at the Tuskegee Institute who wanted you to see the school's lynching archives. Can you give us some sense of that, of what's contained there?
That was an incident in 1986. I was in the South researching my earlier book, and I went to Tuskegee, and I had heard they had something called the Lynching Archives. I hadn't really given much thought to what it would be, and when I arrived and was ushered into the room where it was kept, I was really amazed to see how huge it was. It was these were newspaper clippings about lynchings dating back to the 1880s, and they filled 63 archive boxes. And I was just kind of overwhelmed by it, and it really kind of struck me that lynchings were not aberrational events, but rather part of a systematized method of intimidating and punishing African Americans.
How widespread was the lynching of Black Americans?
Well, it was very, when it really first came to public notice, in other words, it had been going on during Reconstruction, but it was not often recorded. When it came to public notice in the 1880s, it was spread pretty widely across the South. There were always certain states that had higher rates of lynching, such as Georgia, Texas, Mississippi, but essentially it went on everywhere. The high years of lynching were really the 1890s and early 1900s. Some years, Blacks were lynched at a rate of about one every other day in the South.
Hmm. The archives at the Tuskegee Institute, how definitive are they? Do we really know how many of these murders there were?
Well, it's funny because everybody who works in this field, including the people at Tuskegee, will say that the recorded lynchings are really not a fair measure of how many really took place. There have been a lot of estimates of what the actual number would be. The estimates vary so widely that it's probably better to say that no one really knows for sure, but there's often anecdotal evidence of lynchings that had gone unrecorded. These ones, for instance, the nearly 4,000 lynchings of African Americans during the period 1880 to 1944, those are based largely on newspaper clippings. So obviously a lot of lynchings occurred that were never picked up by a newspaper because they took place in isolated surroundings, and because often lynchings were meant to be hushed up. In other words, the whole point of it really was to do away with someone, often without letting anybody know or without letting due process take place, obviously.
Right. Although very often everybody knew about it.
Yes, that's right.
The
there's a strange kind of paradox there. There were different types of lynching. The type of lynching you're referring to was known as the spectacle lynching. It was most common in the 1890s and early 1900s, although examples of it persisted even into the 1930s. What it was a lynching that became like a public event. In fact, spectacle lynchings were among the largest public events in the South in the late 19th century. They could involve as many as 10 or 15,000 people. Typically, a victim would be apprehended, having been accused usually of rape or a related charge, sexual assault, held until a crowd could gather, until proper measures could be taken, and often waiting for, say, an excursion train to arrive from a large city, bringing more spectators. And the lynchings themselves were highly ritualized. They often were stretched out into afternoon-long events. Typically afterward, there'd be a scramble for souvenirs. Postcard photographs were taken and sold. So these were really major events, kind of an opportunity for a community to really kind of strut its stuff, so to speak, and show off. Often you'd even have competing spectacle lynchings, like one town wanting to show that they could pull off a better spectacle lynching than the town down the road 6 months before, this sort of thing.
This just seems too horrific, you know. Is there any record of shame being felt or remorse in a community following such an event?
There almost always was a kind of reaction from the more, what they used to call the better citizens, in other words, of a town, who would voice disapproval. But that wouldn't very rarely involve them actually trying to insert themselves or halt what was about to take place. There were some attempts by various people. Occasionally some lawmen acted very heroically and often at risk to their own lives to try and stave off a mob. But it was very, very difficult. You know, it's hard to imagine. Obviously, there's nothing in a way more impossible to deal with than a violent mob. And even one or two heroic individuals can't really do much. Once lynch mobs revved up, it was very hard to get them to reverse, even when there were many instances where they realized mid-lynching that they had the wrong person, and yet were so full of themselves that it just could not be stopped, and the lynching would go ahead.
Philip Dre is our guest this afternoon. He's the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. We have a listener waiting to talk with us in Champaign on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello. Hi. Just wondering if the victims were ever female.
Yes, there were some female victims of lynching. They often would be implicated or accused for the crime of trying to hide another person's crime. Or sometimes just for simply being related to a hated, for instance, a black man might be accused of a horrendous crime. If he could not be apprehended, his next of kin would do just as well. There actually was a very infamous lynching of a black woman named Mary Turner in Georgia in 1918, which really astounded the nation because she was pregnant. And the manner of her lynching was very, very barbaric and brutal. It was reported widely by the NAACP, who did that sort of there. The NAACP routinely reported the grotesque details of lynching in an effort to awaken the country to what was taking place. And that the lynching of Mary Turner was a very important one for that reason, in that a lot of people were outraged by it.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Also, there was a lynching in Georgia in 1946 that drew a lot of attention, the nation's attention.
Yes.
Where four blacks were killed. And, you know, here I think it would be a good point to remind ourselves that often when we think of lynching, we think of hanging, but it could be any form of murder.
Yes, that's right. In fact, many spectacle lynchings involved immolation, not hanging. But it could be anything, yes, shooting, hanging, immolation. The case you're referring to, the Monroe, Georgia quadruple lynching of 1946, was an incident in which two black couples, two men and two women, were taken out and shot to death. That was a lynching that caused a huge outcry for a couple of reasons. One, because of the victims were two married couples. Secondly, one of the men was a recently returned combat veteran from the Second World War and a decorated veteran. And in that atmosphere, the post-war atmosphere, veterans were kind of, you know, sacrosanct.
Mm-hmm.
And the idea that one of them would be treated in this way just flabbergasted people, including President Truman, who ordered sort of an unprecedented federal investigation of a local lynching. This was not done very often, if at all. The investigation failed to really come up with anything conclusive because of the kind of Sicily-like complicity and silence in these local counties in Georgia. But the fact that the President of the United States had been deeply offended and spoke out about it was in itself unusual.
Yeah. Somehow or other, I feel compelled to mention these people's names, and I'm going to do that. Roger Malcolm and his wife, Dorothy, her brother, George Dorsey, and his wife, May.
That's right, yeah.
This is interesting to me because this situation seems really complex. That the, if you will, forgive me for using this word, the inspiration for these murders, voting rights, a disagreement over money, perhaps a black woman's refusal of the advances of a white man who employed her husband.
Yes.
Boy.
Right. It's kind of, it's difficult to really know for certain. One of the interesting things about that lynching was that it took place against the background of a political campaign in Georgia, in which one of the issues was the expanded voting rights for blacks. And it was said that one of the lynchers said to one of the victims of that lynching, "I bet you voted the other day."
Mm-hmm.
And so whether or not this was a direct inspiration, as you put it, it was definitely, the atmosphere was extremely tense in rural Georgia at that time over this issue. So that no doubt contributed to it.
Yeah. Well, you know, here at play we see, you know, black people as a threat to whites with voting.
Mm-hmm.
And then also we have an economic disagreement.
Yes.
And then we have a black woman refusing the advances of a white man.
Right.
And it's interesting because that turns, that sort of turns something around that we see often in the case of lynchings of black men, and that is the threat to, the sexual threat to white women.
Yes. Well, I think the sexual component in racial violence in the South in the 19th century was very, very dominant, really. In other words, I think it's there a lot. It's sort of reading the tea leaves a little bit, but even in accounts from Reconstruction, right after the Civil War, where there was violence between slaves and their former masters, if you look back at the records, there often was one of the components was some sort of sexual or romantic kind of dysfunction of somebody wanting to get their children back, or a former slave objecting to the amorous advances of a former planter toward a black woman. I mean, one reason the sharecropping system became popular in the late 19th century among blacks in the South was because it removed black women from the direct oversight of white men. In other words, that system allowed for blacks to operate. It was obviously an unfair system, and there were a lot of injustices attached to it. But at least physically, it removed the overseer. It allowed blacks to function with a degree of autonomy. And one of the ingredients in that was that it separated black women from direct contact with white men who had power over them. For this, and thereby, somewhat diminished the risk of sexual harassment, molestation, etc. But yes, it's a very powerful component, and in lynching as well. It was the chief rationale used in most lynchings, even when the actual reason was something, could be anything, like a white man's coveting a black man's land or his success in business or what have you, the cry of rape was often used. It would never fail to arouse a posse or a lynch mob.
Yeah. I know that the Associated Press has done an outstanding series in recent months over how the land of African Americans was taken from them by unscrupulous whites through terror and through lynchings and all kinds of violence.
Well, it's true that lynching was... One thing I didn't know before I worked on this book was the degree to which lynching was a very strong element in the northward migration of blacks from the South around the turn of the century, what they call the Great Migration. A large number, I think about 1.5 million African Americans are believed to have headed north during that period. And, of course, there were many different motivations, economic, etc. But you can't underestimate the sheer terror of lynching. Even for people who never saw lynching or were nowhere near it, the idea of it was so intimidating that it was often cited as the reason why people were lured to such northern cities as Chicago, Detroit, etc.
The records at Tuskegee date from 1882, but it's from the year 1886 and on that more blacks than whites are being lynched.
Yeah.
Let's just talk just a little bit about white lynchings. Were they largely confined to the West in terms of vigilante justice, that kind of a thing?
The kind of like cattle rustler lynchings and all? You know, I can't claim to be much of an authority on white lynchings. It's true that I have a feeling that there's probably more to them than is commonly known. In other words, I possess what are probably largely traditional views on it. I did find that one thing about vigilante-style justice, say in the West, is that even to this present day, it's remembered in many places as having been sort of civic-minded. In other words, vigilante committees of the mid-19th century were historically given credit for having made certain areas inhabitable, basically, by cleaning up rogues, card cheats, swindlers, cattle rustlers, what have you. I have a feeling that were you to look into that, you'd find deeper trends there. For instance, I have a hunch, and I think there has been scholarship in this area, that even there, many of the victims were not actually white at all, but tended to be disproportionately Asian, Mexican, Native American. So in other words, it could have been that that was at work there as well.
Yeah.
But yes, it's true that, in other words, your basic question is, yes, their vigilante justice throughout the 19th century was often seen as a public good. It's a very strong current in all American life, really. It has to do with our own identity, really, because the American Revolution was, in a sense, a rebellion against authority. And there's a very strong current of belief in America that local communities can handle their own problems, that the people know best. These are not unhealthy attitudes in many senses. They sort of are who we are. But when it came to dealing with criminals, it often meant that people were willing to obviate due process in order to get at a more lasting kind of people's justice.
You know, as a kid watching television and at the movies, the stories that were told on the screen, large and small, screens that is, gave me an understanding that the law was to be respected in large part because the law was to protect the safety and well-being of the citizenry and of individuals who are suspected or who were caught red-handed. From arrest through trial. Now, in this history of lynching in this country, that doesn't jive with what I learned from watching television and the movies. The deal was you get a fair trial. Has the nation, over its history, did the nation see a shift in its understanding of due process?
Well, I think what happened was that for one thing, I think there is still a very basic tension along that line. In other words, there's always a tension between respect for due process and the needs of the populace to feel safe from criminals. And as you know, even to this day, we still argue about Miranda rights, about such things as Megan's Law. In other words, where the people are feel threatened, they often will act to shortchange or short-circuit due process, in other words, to feel more secure themselves. What actually happened, though, was that the federal judiciary basically stepped in, starting in the early 1920s, and began addressing the issue of what constituted due process and what constituted a fair criminal trial. In a certain way, this was in response to lynching, spectacle lynching, and also what they called legal lynching, which were trials which really were just like lynchings because the defendant had absolutely no chance. Even his own defense attorney didn't believe he had a chance. There'd be a mob outside the courthouse, you know, chanting that this person be given the death sentence. And these trials often were over in 10 or 15 minutes. And so in response to this, the Supreme Court began laying down rulings that guaranteed certain aspects of a criminal trial, including that a mob could not be present, the defense attorney had to be competent, blacks had to be allowed on the jury, various other protections. And it all culminated in the 1960s when the Supreme Court put the teeth back in the Reconstruction laws that were originally meant to protect freedmen in the South from conspiracies against them. In other words, that's what happened in the Goodman-Schwerner-Cheney case, the killing of the three civil rights workers in Mississippi. The Supreme Court finally said, if the state won't prosecute these lynch mobs, the federal government will use these old Reconstruction conspiracy statutes to do so.
Mm. Our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine is Philip Dre. He is the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. He's also the author, co-author of We Are Not Afraid, the story of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I welcome your questions and comments this afternoon. Join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Thank goodness your book includes many stories about people who fought to end lynching. One of these people, Ida B. Wells,
right,
a former slave, she became a journalist. Tell us about her efforts as an anti-lynching reformer.
She was a really, Ida Wells was a really remarkable person. She worked as a teacher and journalist in Memphis in the early 1890s. She wrote for a black newspaper. And what really got her into the lynching cause was that three men who were her friends opened a grocery store in Memphis, which began doing better business than one owned by a white man nearby. The white man sort of prompted a falling out with them. Gunshots were exchanged. The three blacks were arrested and taken to jail. A couple of nights later, a lynch mob came and took them out and shot them to death. Now, Ida Wells realized then that the lynching ethos, which centered around this idea of rape, was really just being used as a way to kind of disguise just the kind of methods of whites keeping blacks down, basically, as in the case of her three friends. So she began investigating lynchings herself, and she found that in a number of cases, rape was alleged, but really there was no substance to support that. So she began editorializing about it, thus enraging the white citizens of Memphis who trashed the offices of the newspaper she worked at and basically drove her out of the South. She really never returned to the South after that. She went to Britain because in those days we looked to Britain and Europe for sort of a public opinion to sort of see, sort of like children going to their parents a little bit, to see what they would say about it. The abolitionists like Frederick Douglass had done this before Ida Wells. And basically the strategy worked. Ida Wells made two trips to Britain. The English press began editorializing very strongly against lynching. And thus this influenced the American press to also begin looking at it in a much more serious way.
Mm. What role did the nation's newspapers and magazines play in promoting race, hate, and fear?
Well, the newspapers are kind of notorious in a way. In some lynchings, they were really basically complicit. There's a scholar who has referred to lynching coverage as the folk pornography of the Bible Belt. And if you look back at old accounts of lynchings, you realize these were sensational events that had everything, really. They had fair-haired maidens. They had big black brutes. They had noble men who joined the lynch mob or posse, to restore order. And so the newspapers really went to town with these stories and often exaggerated or embellished details to make these sound like almost these kind of, you know, mythical events, really, of order and right being restored to a community. And really, in a sense, were kind of irresponsible because very, very rarely would the newspapers call for law to be respected and say, well, let's hold on here a minute. Instead, they'd be saying, well, tomorrow there'll be a lynching in such and such a community, and, you know, thus, in a sense, promoting the lynching, really.
Yeah, well, there was such a case that involved the radio.
Yeah, that's a really infamous case, especially because it happened during the 1930s, 1934 in the Florida Panhandle. Yes, a man was, Claude Neal, was accused of rape and murder. In that instance, the sheriff tried to hide him in an Alabama jail 150 miles away, thinking he'd be safe. The lynch mob found out about it and drove all the way there, took him from the jail, drove him all the way back to a small town in Florida. By then, word had leaked out to the local radio station. It was then picked up by the Associated Press. And you had this incredible thing of people in New York City hearing on their radios about an impending lynching in a small town in Florida. And, of course, people were helpless to do anything because the lynch mob had this man out in the woods somewhere. No one knew how to find him or how to stop it. And it was a very helpless feeling, really, that people had. And afterwards, a lot of sparks flew over that lynching because it was so humiliating to everybody from whoever was involved, from President Roosevelt on down, the governor of Florida. The NAACP investigated it and disseminated a report about it very, very widely to politicians and the press.
Yeah. Boy, the black press was just so critical, wasn't it?
I'm sorry, the what?
The black press. Ida B. Wells and others like
her. Oh, yes. Oh, well, the black press was really activist at that time. In fact, one newspaper, the Chicago Defender, took lynching, they confronted it directly by, the Defender was public, it was, distributed widely in the South. And it basically said to Southern blacks, you've got to get out of the South. You've got to come north. It didn't mince words. It said lynching is completely out of control. No one can stop it. And you and your family would do best to just get on a train and get out of there as quickly as you can. For that reason, the Chicago Defender was banned by whites in many Southern states because obviously the whites didn't want to see the labor force leave. Robert Abbott, the editor of the Defender, was sort of like, public enemy number one in the South because he was right in, he was taking a very direct approach to it. Mm-hmm. And similarly, yes, the NAACP, W.E.B. Du Bois wrote eloquently about lynching in The Crisis, the NAACP paper, as had Ida Wells and many other journalists. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. The NAACP was created after a horrific riot in Springfield, Illinois, just an hour and a half from here by car, in 1908.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about what happened over the course of just a couple of days in Springfield in August 1908.
Yeah, that was a famous incident in that the town was just gearing up for the centenary of Lincoln's birth. And right in the midst of this, two black men were held in jail accused of sexual assault. A lynch mob, actually the mob was led by a woman, which was very unusual, a woman named Kate Howard, tried to get at these men, and the sheriff managed to sneak them out by having them hide on the floor of an automobile. and got them out of town. Well, the mob was doubly enraged and just basically went on a rampage in the two black neighborhoods in Springfield. They did eventually kill two other black men who were completely innocent and really leveled a lot of the town, did quite a bit of damage. The impact this had was that because this was happened in Abraham Lincoln's hometown, and also because it was Springfield was considered, in a sense, a northern town because it was in Illinois, it really alarmed a lot of northern, both white and black progressives, who thought this was really going too far. It also, in a practical way, suggested that lynching was going to follow the northward migration of blacks. So here you had this thing that had been considered a kind of bizarre southern custom. People saw it now moving north, and this was just completely unacceptable. And so it triggered the several people in New York to call a group together to basically revive the spirit of the abolitionists. In other words, a biracial group of Americans who would really address themselves to righting all kinds of racial wrongs, including lynching, which was one of the first things the NAACP went after.
Yeah. So with Springfield and with some other lynchings, Coatesville, Pennsylvania, and
yes.
There were some other lynchings in the North as well. We begin to own up to lynching as an American problem, as a national problem.
That's right, yes. And it was reinforced very much around the time of the First World War, because here you had the U.S. involved in this kind of international crusade against, you know, the barbaric Huns and anarchy, Bolsheviks, what have you. And it was sort of through that prism that people began to see that America had its own problems of, you know, ethnic intolerance and violence that were really had to be sort of brought under control. I mean, some of the most effective propaganda the NAACP used was after the First World War by saying, you know, you're worried about anarchists. What are people in lynch mobs? There are hundreds of anarchists. That's anarchy in its purest form. And that really struck home with a lot of people.
Yeah. They were the terrorists of their day.
That's right, in a way. It's like, of course, you hate to kind of, you know, nowadays it's so, sort of everything bounces back to terrorists. But it's true that lynching was, it was similar to terrorism, only in that it penetrated really far. In other words, the idea of it and the act was so barbaric and so unthinkable, really, that it really affected people who were never anywhere near it. If you read a good, someone who really works that angle is Richard Wright, the black author. Many of his short stories and novels revolve around this idea of black people living under this, with this fear of this sort of ultimate violence directed against them. Even though it never comes, just the knowledge of it is so paralyzing.
Mm-hmm. How does the history of lynching, our past history, affect us today?
Well, one reason I think the subject is so haunting is because I think we all know that we've never really dealt completely successfully with a lot of the racial divisiveness in our country. I mean, that's sort of a no-brainer in a way. I think specifically there are certain vestiges of lynching that come to mind. I guess among them, you know, racial profiling, the disproportionate number of blacks who are behind bars, you know, sentencing related to drug possession and sales, and all kinds of other things that don't even involve race necessarily, that just have to do with criminal law, whether it's the argument over the Miranda rights, even arguments about, you know, whether family members should be allowed to influence sentencing of criminals. Mm-hmm. These are issues that have to do with whether due process is a matter of law or to what extent people can have an it can take part in it. In other words, victims and victims' families, that sort of thing.
Yeah. In recent years, we've talked a good deal about hate crimes.
Mm-hmm.
You can share your thoughts about that debate and discussion.
Well, it's interesting in a way because, of course, hate crimes are, I mean, some hate crimes today would have been called lynchings many years ago. Even though lynching technically is supposed to involve a denial of due process, and so some hate crimes wouldn't necessarily qualify. But yes, fortunately, hate crimes have not risen to the kind of epidemic proportion that lynchings once had. But it's a, obviously, yes, it's a very, they're kind of an echo of lynching in a way. And also, it also echoes it in that there's a debate about whether or not there should be laws, like, say, a federal hate crimes law, that sort of thing. Just as there was for lynching, there was a long debate in Congress whether or not to have a federal anti-lynching law. It never succeeded, but it engaged the country for many years from, say, the First World War to the end of the Second World War.
Hmm. We have another caller waiting to talk with us in Lake Bloomington on the toll-free line. Good afternoon.
Hi there.
Hi.
I wondered if you'd comment on Mark Twain's essay called The United States of Lynchardom.
I don't have that in front of me. I do know in my book I actually quote from another. I use another Twain quote, which is from The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn. Yeah, as you know, Mark Twain was, he thought lynching was real. I mean, he went after it many, many times. The example I use is one where he's kind of mocking a lynch mob that comes, you know, they come storming up to a front porch of a courthouse, ready to reckon with someone, and this the intended victim kind of stands up to them,
right,
and says, "Who do you think you are? You're just, you know, you're full of hot air, basically." And they all kind of skulk away. I kind of use it to refer to the sheriffs. There was kind of a movement in the early 20th century for local lawmen to be rewarded or acknowledged by the NAACP and other groups for their heroism in protecting prisoners from lynch mobs. And there were many examples of sheriffs during this period standing up to mobs, either outsmarting them, occasionally shooting into them, which was much heralded when it happened. But yes, you're right. Mark Twain was very cutting and very sarcastic on the subject of lynching.
Really, and that's a very powerful scene in Huckleberry Finn. He also, though, at the end of this essay, you know, we'd been sending a lot of missionaries to China at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Oh, good missionaries, oh, kind missionaries, come home and convert these Christians."
Ah, I see,
which,
yeah.
You'd think would have gotten him into a lot of trouble.
Right. Well, he was always kind of out there on the edge a little bit.
For sure.
Yeah. Well, you know, another person who, like Twain, really was obsessed with lynching in a way was the writer H.L. Mencken, the editor of the American Mercury. He attacked lynching many, many times in his magazine, and he was famous for making the comment that he thought that if every small town in the South could just be sent a brass band, there wouldn't be any more lynchings. In other words, implying that it was just because life was so vacuous in some of these communities that...
It shows how little it took to entertain people.
That's
in
right.
Those too, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, listen, thank you so much
sure,
for your
for
comments.
Bye.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited. Questions, comments, join us with a telephone call in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, Philip Dre, the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. My name is Celeste Quinn. Again, those numbers, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. In the book, in the section of the book where we read about Springfield, Illinois, and we hear about the creation of the NAACP, and W.E. Du Bois is there, Mary White Ovington, William English Walling, these folks, there's also a discussion of the war on lynching becoming one, or the realization that it would be one of language, of words, of who was going to, you know, set the terms for the debate.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very interesting. And there is a little, there's a little anecdote in there about a meeting of the NAACP in New York City, and how that was reported in, I don't know if it was one newspaper, or I guess it was Southern newspapers.
Mm-hmm.
And it was written up as if this meeting of the NAACP had just been an orgy.
Yes, right.
You know, and You write in there parenthetically, if I'm recalling correctly, that some suspect that Booker T. Washington tipped a Southern paper or a Southern reporter
right.
or somebody off to this meeting in New York City. And I guess at this point in history, we sort of have a really mixed view of Booker T. Washington.
Right. Well, that was, of course, just a rumor, but he had been, Booker T. Washington, just for people who don't know, was from about the 1890s on, he was really considered like the sort of the most prominent black American. And his program, he was the head of the Tuskegee Institute and an educator. He was friends with a lot of powerful white men. He was also very respected in the black community. But his basic philosophy at the time was that everything is kind of arranged against black Americans. They're being disenfranchised. There's Plessy v. Ferguson, Jim Crow, etc. That the best the blacks could do is simply to sort of hunker down and modestly prove themselves as good citizens and workers, but not place too many demands on whites. In other words, not be given, in other words, to be satisfied with not having certain rights for the time being, such as voting access, equal accommodation, public accommodations, and that sort of thing. And his philosophy kind of ruled for many years, but what the NAACP really represented was a culmination of a kind of a growing dissatisfaction with Washington's accommodationist stance. And really a sense that, no, we have to get much more aggressive about this. We can't just sit and wait for white America to kind of pat us on the head and acknowledge that we're being good and hopefully give us something. Hmm. We have to take the fight right to them and demand these things. That's really where, and that's why Booker T. Washington took a kind of a, he was sort of disinvited from the NAACP gathering, the first one. You know, they let him know they weren't too eager for him to come. And, yes, that's why there was that rumor that he was a very powerful person. He influenced a lot of journalists and politicians, black and white. And so anybody who did anything sort of against him or as an alternative to him had reason to fear that he would kind of try to, obstruct it somehow.
Yeah. We're at the point where we've got to wrap up here. And to do that, I want to ask you this question. Is the book drawing a good deal of interest? And I assume you've been traveling and talking with people about this history. Is the book drawing a good deal of interest, and is it drawing interest from blacks and whites?
I haven't traveled all that much, but where I have traveled, in the South particularly, it's been very interesting. For instance, in Atlanta, in this May, they're going to have the exhibit of postcard photographs called Without Sanctuary of lynchings at the King Center in Atlanta. And that was a decision that has not pleased everybody in Atlanta. It was sort of controversial. It is going to go forward, though. So lynching is still a subject that's fairly raw, particularly in the South. It's not one that either blacks or whites really warm to too readily. In my experience, I have found that black readers are more, they understand the issue much more, they have a much more sophisticated sense of it than whites do. And many people have sort of thanked me for the book in that it tells a history that has been basically covered up or ignored for many years.
Mm-hmm. It doesn't appear in your standard textbooks in school.
Well, you know, it's interesting because up until about 1930, say from 1895 to 1930, lynching was a very big topic in America. And there were several small books about the history of lynching and what we should we do about it. Those were more, at the time, those were like current events kind of books, basically. But since that time, no one has really written a book like mine that is a history of lynching sort of from the beginning through what might be called the end. Trying to kind of capture the trajectory of it.
Mm. What's your next project?
I'm really not sure at this point. I tell you the truth, I'm really being honest about that, too. I've been so engrossed in the both working on this book and then going out and promoting it, which itself, in a way, has been kind of an extension of writing it because it's such a volatile subject, that I'm not really sure. I'm trying to, I think within a month or two, I'll sort of, this will be a little behind me and I can kind of focus. But whether or not it'll be another book in the, you know, Black Studies area, I'm not sure, but quite possibly.
Mm. Thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Okay, thanks, Celeste.
Philip Dre has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of At the Hands of Persons Unknown, The Lynching of Black America. The book is published by Random House.